Some people find themselves drawn together in unusual ways and through quite unexpected circumstances. That's exactly what happened with Pat and Allison and their family.
I realized, wow, I've never seen a father interact with children this well, and here he wasn't even their father.
I think at some point maybe we had this magical friendship together.
You know, and he was the hired caretaker. I simply couldn't believe the magic that I was seeing day in and day out.
It's not so much how their love has developed over the past 20 years, but rather the strange sequence of events that brought them together in the first place. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
There are 66 million fathers in America today, and despite the faltering economy, it's expected that over 90 million Father's Day cards are being bought for these dads this weekend. Pat Keenan is a man who spent the better part of his life assuming that he'd never be a dad, and certainly never get a card saying thanks for being that dad. Pat served in Vietnam at a very young age. He came back to the U.S. and found himself leading a pretty lonely existence. Years passed. One evening in Austin, Texas, he finally tried to figure out what was wrong.
I was kind of living on a rooftop of a building with a bunch of other winos, and one guy said to me, you know, or I said to him, you know, what do you think's wrong? I just seem to can't keep a job, and, you know, now I've got no place to live. And the guy said, you know, you're a drunk. And I said, you're kidding. And he said, no. I said, what do I do? He said, well, you quit drinking, and you get some help. And so I did. I just... That day, didn't pick up a drink again, started putting my life back together, moved back to Chicago, joined some support groups. And the first thing I noticed is that I needed an education because here I was 30 years old and had basically a ninth grade education. So getting the GED and getting into college and then starting with the job situation, building a career. And I decided, well, I'll be a social worker and help other people, especially Vietnam vets. I had no money and no car. I was delivering newspapers. I was driving taxis. You name it, I would do it.
Pat wound up with a job caring for an elderly gentleman. He moved into the man's apartment to do this, so that meant he had a job and a place to stay and a chance to continue his studies. At the same time, Allison Carday had just moved to town. She'd left behind her an abusive marriage, and she was facing some of the same obstacles. She needed a job and a place of her own, but she knew she couldn't do anything until she arranged childcare for her two young sons, Tyler and Clay.
It wasn't going. I mean, I talked to a lot of people, but nothing really seemed to be working out.
What was the problem?
I didn't have any money. I didn't have any extra money to pay somebody for this service. I asked if my mother would mind picking them up, and she said, okay. But she said, look, I'll do it until the beginning of January. Do you think that's fair, that will give you enough time to find some other arrangement? And I said, sure, let's really work on that. And I did. All I had was a spare bedroom. That's really all I had, and it wasn't enough for anybody I talked to. They wanted a job.
And you weren't close to a campus. You couldn't sort of look at the chance of maybe bringing in a grad student or something like that.
I actually called. There's a Christian college not too far from where I was living. I called them, and they said that they'd put something, you know, on the board, but nothing materialized. I thought, well, maybe I could find a woman that needed a place to live, and then she could take care of my boys. But I interviewed maybe three or four, and they didn't speak English very well, and they didn't have a car, and that didn't work out.
So you were putting ads in the newspaper saying, you know, I need a live-in babysitter. I need someone to live with me who can help out with childcare. What were you doing to actually look for someone?
I wasn't. I was just calling agencies is what I was doing.
Yeah.
And then watching the paper for someone that might have advertised for someone, you know, that I could respond to.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Allison was making things work. She got a job. She had the apartment, but she still didn't have the childcare help that she needed.
It was Thanksgiving morning, and I picked up the very small local paper. I was looking in the personals, and there was an ad that said, "We'll take care of your elderly parent in exchange for room. Call Pat." And then the telephone number had the the local exchange from the little town that I was from. So I said, oh, this might really work. I wonder, you know, what this could be. Maybe I even know this person. So I called, and the woman that answered, you know, was very gracious, and I apologized for calling on Thanksgiving morning. But I explained I was sort of desperate, and I was looking for someone that could take care of my sons, and maybe Pat would be able to do that. And she went on to say, you know, well, Pat had taken care of her elderly father-in-law, and they just loved Pat, and Pat was going to school to get a degree in social work, and Pat was wonderful, and on and on. And it was a couple minutes into the conversation, and I said, well, when could I talk to her? And this woman said, well, who? And I said, well, Pat, I'd like to talk to Pat. And she said, oh, there's been a terrible mistake. Pat's a man. And I said, oh, and I started to laugh. And I said, yes, there has been a mistake, and I'm so sorry to bother you, and happy Thanksgiving. And then I went to my family's Thanksgiving and had a great story to tell, you know, around the table. I said, the funniest thing happened this morning. And my sister-in-law said, you know, Allison, if the boys are going to have the life that I think they're going to have, maybe if Pat's as great as this woman says, or half as great, he would be a nice male role model for them. And my mother at the other end of the table sort of gasped and said, oh, what will I tell my bridge group? There can't be a man moving in with you.
Well, it's not like you've got a big rooming house and he's going to be on the third floor. You've got an apartment and he's going to have one of the bedrooms in the apartment, right?
Yes, but it was set up kind of differently. There were two bedrooms on one side of the apartment with a shared bathroom. Uh-huh. Then there was kind of a long L-shaped living room, dining room that separated those bedrooms from my bedroom on the other end, and I had a bathroom. So it was laid out kind of nicely. And so I continued to look, and nothing else was materializing. It was getting to be the beginning of December. And I said, you know, I'm going to call this person back and just see if he might be interested in, instead of an elderly parent, taking care of my two little boys once a week. And so I called him, and he said, let me think about it. And he called me back. He said, I'd consider it.
What's the voice that you're hearing at the other end of the phone? Because I know from my life here in radio land that we make pretty quick and firm judgments about people based on the sound of their voice.
He was kind of laid back. He had a very distinct northwest side of Chicago accent. And, you know, he was pleasant, and he wasn't, you know, he was as tentative as I was. He said, you know, I would consider it. Let me think about it. And he called back and said, I'm willing to take the next step and meet with you and see. And so, you know, I think we both kind of walked into it thinking, well, let's just see.
You know, I was in a situation where I had taken care of a gentleman who was, I think he was 95 or 96, and he had passed away. And I was kind of in college for the first time, going for my degree in social work. And I had really very limited funds at the time. And so I moved into the YMCA, and it wasn't a very nice place at all. It had a bed, a window that didn't open, and one of the old radiators that was on all the time. It was always 90 degrees in there, and a community shower. So it wasn't a great place to stay. But when I got the phone call, I think I was somewhat excited about an opportunity to get out of the YMCA. And I was kind of focused on taking care of an elderly person, because that had worked for a good year or so for me. But I think I had an open mind to it, and so I think we both agreed to meet up.
What did you hear in Allison's voice when she called? Do you remember?
A professional person, competent, willing to take a risk to meet up.
And, but it was business, right? They had that kind of business-like quality to it?
It was total business, and I was in a situation where, you know, that's all I really thought about was, gee, $35 a week at the YMCA, and I can get rid of that and possibly live for free and take care of a couple kids. I thought, well, I'm willing to move forward.
And so we decided to meet at the local McDonald's. It seemed like a very safe place. In the meantime, though, I had called his references. You know, I couldn't find anything bad about the guy. I mean, they just were glowing. And I thought, well, you know, maybe this is kind of an answer to a real desperate need I had.
Well, how did the meeting at McDonald's go?
He was very nice. He was on time.
in walks Allison and these two little kids, real cute kids. And we just sat down and we ordered some McNuggets and some French fries. We were just kind of sitting there getting to know each other. And I just thought, well, I'll just, you know, be myself and see what happens with the kids. And, you know, the next thing I knew, I found myself, when the kids weren't looking, taking one of their McNuggets and eating it. And so they caught me doing that and they kind of laughed. And so we just kind of started, you know, chuckling a little bit and getting along.
My younger son, Clay, was crawling on him by the end of the meeting, you know, just having fun. You know, my son was laughing and having fun.
I think Allison was saying, like, you know, maybe this thing might just work. And mm-hmm. I thought, you know, this is way different. Two young kids, and I'm not really sure that I'd be really that good. And I had never been this responsible of a person. And so for her to trust me was a big stretch on her part.
So I think we went back to the apartment and I showed him. And I remember being very apologetic that it wasn't, you know, a fancy apartment or anything. And he said, oh, this looks great. I thought, well,
did you know he was living at the Y at the time?
No, I didn't know that. I didn't know where he was. So I didn't realize what he was comparing it to. So he looked at me and said, sure, this looks great. And Pat went back. He said, I'm going to think about it a little bit more. And he called me. He said, yeah, I think this would work. I'll move in the beginning of January.
I wasn't, you know, totally excited about it, but I wasn't thinking, you know, this is the worst thing in the world. And I thought, it's unusual, to say the least, moving in a small apartment with two boys and a single mother and thinking, you know, I could probably do the job, but, you know, was it the right thing to do or not? But I decided that, you know, looking at the YMCA and looking at my situation, that this was certainly a step up for me.
I know what you're thinking. Single mom, two young boys, guy moves in. It didn't happen that way. You see, Allison Carday was way too cautious to even think about that. She'd already been married to a man who was abusive, and she wasn't going to let her guard down. She was watching out for the well-being of her boys and her own peace of mind. In just a moment, chapter 2, in what Pat and Allison have come to refer to as their magical friendship. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. There was a time when Allison Carday would have told you there's no way that she and her two young boys would ever celebrate a Father's Day with any joy in it. Her first marriage was a miserable one. She was far away from friends and family living on the West Coast. Her husband at the time was an angry man, abusive. And Allison finally decided she had to leave.
It felt like an escape for me. And I had been threatening to leave for a number of years. And I remember my sister-in-law saying to me, if you don't leave now, when are you going to leave? You're going to wait till you're 40 and have three or four kids? When is it going to be right? So I felt a little bit pushed up against the wall. And I said, I guess it's now or never. And I just jumped. And I didn't have anything with me except a suitcase and these two little boys that were dependent on me. I didn't have a job or a place to stay or anything.
And did you have any safety concerns, Allison, having left this marriage? Was that an issue at all?
It really was, Dick. He had never beaten my kids or myself to the point where, you know, we were hospitalized. But I had come to understand that his kind of abuse was progressive. And I was real happy that I had gotten out when I did.
Did you worry at all about your safety in the Chicago area, that you'd be okay there?
You know, I don't think so, because I don't think he was a bully, but he was kind of wily too. And I think he knew that I was in my own territory. So I don't think he would have come and hurt me physically. He called all the time begging me to come back, but I wasn't too worried that he was going to come and hurt us in the Chicago area. And I went and lived with my parents for 6 weeks. And my goal was to have a job and a place to stay and a good spot for the boys by the time I moved out the beginning of September. And I did that. I was able to kind of pull it together.
What kind of work did you find?
Well, I lied my way into a job selling advertising, and it paid me enough money to have an apartment, and I could pay all my bills. There was nothing extra, but I felt very good about that.
How big a lie did you have to tell to get this job?
You know, I said that I had all kinds of experience, and what I had was about 6 weeks' experience. And it turns out that the woman that hired me, she had gone to the same high school that I had gone to. So we reminisced a little bit about that. And then we got down to the interview, and I just felt like, oh, thank God. You know, I had something, some kind of reference point that I could make with her. And she said, I'm going to take a chance with you. And she did.
You know, when you look at that time, leaving a bad marriage with kids who are 2 and 4, coming back home and actually getting yourself set up with your own place and a job in that short period of time, you must have felt some satisfaction over how things were turning out.
You know, I really did. When I came out of California and came back here, I had one goal in mind, and that was not to go on food stamps. I just couldn't imagine how, you know, low I would have felt if I had gone on food stamps. So that was my goal, is just to do whatever I could to support the boys. And so it was a survival thing. I said, okay, I'm able to support myself and these little boys. And I felt like, it's going to sound funny, but I felt like a grown-up, maybe for the first time.
So that's Allison, living with her boys at one end of her apartment. The man, this new live-in babysitter, was a guy called Pat. He was living at the other end of the apartment with his own family history.
My mother had 9 kids to take care of. My father was a college professor who also ran the bookstores at DePaul University, so he was busy all the time just making ends meet. And I just kind of slid through the radar. So by the time I got to high school, I was totally lost. I really didn't even make it out of the first year. You know, I was the one in the back hiding behind a book taking a nap after lunch because I thought everybody should take a nap. And I kind of escaped. There was 40 or 50 kids in a classroom. I don't think I learned anything.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Allison didn't know much about Pat's background, but she had a sense that he was a decent guy and someone who was both willing and capable of caring for her 2 sons in exchange for a room.
Was very professional in the beginning. This is what the boys eat. This is when they go to bed. These are the books they like to read. It was that sort of thing. But very quickly, I'm thinking, you know, maybe 3 or 4 weeks, I noticed that when the boys went to bed, you know, there was only one living room, one TV, and we would go in there and watch TV. And we started telling our stories and sharing with each other our backgrounds. And I think we were both kind of wounded, and it was nice to have someone safe to talk to about it. And, you know, he heard my story, and there was not a lot of judging, and I heard his story, and I thought, well, this is fascinating. And we spent a lot of time talking, and so it was very pleasant. I became less on guard about, you know, who this person is that came into my home, and felt, you know, he's a very nice person.
So that kind of companionship came actually early on, that comfort of just having the other person around.
Yes. You know, and being a single woman, it was just nice having another adult in the house too. You know, if I heard a bang in the middle of the night, I used to think, oh no, do I need to get up and investigate it? I felt much more comfortable now.
You know, I got in the house, and I think that I was a little uncomfortable, not too much. But the boys, I just kind of kept things really light with them, and automatically we just started having fun. I had no problem just kind of fitting in with – in fact, fitting with the boys was very comfortable with me. Allison, I just kind of – well, we did fine together, but my focus really was just kind of having fun with them. And within a very short time, we were wrestling. We were just having fun. We'd go out for a hot dog, and I wasn't being a father. I wasn't being a caretaker. I was just this guy that came in their life, and it was easy for everybody. And it wasn't work for me anymore.
Did you, Allison, see a change in the boys after Pat was in the house?
It was dramatic, and I didn't realize what was missing until Pat came into the house, and I said, oh, this is very different than the way it's been. You know, I'd been proud of the fact that I was the sole provider and I was doing a darn good job, but there was no joy. And I remember thinking to myself, this is like in The Wizard of Oz when it's black and white in the beginning, and all of a sudden something happens magical and there's color. And that's what Pat brought into the family life. And we started going to the museums down in Chicago on the weekends when he wasn't working. And it was just joy.
Were you able to do this without any of the, you know, complications of, did I say something to offend him? Is he looking at me?
The boy-girl stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. What, that
it wasn't that at all. No, you know why? Because we both realized how important the job part of it working out was. So we kept it professional, first and foremost. It was, am I doing an okay job or am I providing an okay space for you to live, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was the most important. We wanted to protect the job working out for both of us primarily. And then the other thing was Pat was seeing somebody else and I was dating somebody else. And so what we became was friends. Started out as polite, and then it probably moved into friendly, and then it became friends. But the boy-girl stuff was really kept out of it, probably by design.
I bet other people were asking questions, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You mean the, how's the Korean houseboy doing?
Wait a second. Where did that come from? Tell me that story.
Yeah. That came from Allison's father, who was a businessman. And, well, he would say, how's the Korean houseboy going to Allison? And then when we would come over once in a while to his house, he kind of looked at me like, you know, you're just a hanger on here and you're, you know, you're not really a man and you're really, I just don't get it. And you're probably using my daughter. And there was no respect there on his side. And that was a little bit uncomfortable on my part. But Allison's mother was this very proper Boston woman. She was always very sweet and proper.
But was she still worried about what to say at the Bridge Club, or was she getting past
that? I think it was a big topic at the Bridge Club. And I think there was like some oh my's and oh, I don't know about that type of thing. And
Allison
was a very spiritual lady and had an open mind to it. And then I think at some point she started seeing her daughter happy.
Huh.
And when she saw Allison smile and relax, I think that she knew this was a good thing.
Allison, did you feel awkward by what your dad said?
You know, my father said a lot of things. So this was about par for the course. And, you know, I would have to do a disclaimer with Pat. I'd say, well, he's probably going to say something rude to you and just ignore it like the rest of us do. And, Pat, you know, just he never took offense. He was very disarming in his manner. And so my father would sort of throw out one of these attacks, waiting for probably for Pat to respond angrily or negatively. And Pat wouldn't. And I think it was probably kind of frustrating for my dad because he'd say, well, oh, so you brought the Korean houseboy with you. How are you? And Pat would say, I'm doing really well. How are you, Bob? You know? And so there was just, Pat didn't pick it up. And so my father sort of gave up after a while.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. If this is a Father's Day story, it's not about Allison and her dad. It is about Allison and Pat and her two boys, Tyler and Clay. But at this moment, it's about just Allison and Pat.
We had gotten through the winter together, and we would get home from work and talk for hours. I'd found myself doing dishes and talking, and it looked like a married couple type situation, but we weren't intimate with each other. So when the boys went away for the summer, Allison and I really spent the whole summer together. We would take walks, and I tried to get Allison to start jogging with me a little bit, and we were doing some bike riding, and we might go to Ravinia to a concert, and I think at some point maybe we had this magical friendship together.
I remember my sister saying, you're spending all your time with this guy. I'd say, yeah. And she'd say, well, are you guys dating? I'd say, no, not really. I think both of us were afraid of ruining something. It was so good and yet so different from anything I'd ever had before. Yeah. And, you know, I still needed someone to take care of my sons when I traveled. So I was afraid that, gee, if you date someone and then you break up, then, you know, that person probably doesn't live in your house and take care of your kids. So, you know, we couldn't really say that we were a couple. We just were very happy to be together. And then it started to be, well, gee, I want to kiss him and I want to be with him.
I mean, would you walk arm in arm or hold hands or would you kiss at this point? Or were you, did you have this kind of firewall of intimacy between you where, you know, we can't cross that line?
We may have done a month of hand-holding before we had our first kiss or anything, and then we would sit on the couch and watch a movie or something for an hour, and I might put her arm around her or something, but we were both so hesitant to really go any farther.
And then we went to visit his family in Indiana, and I remember on the way to Mass on Sunday morning, Pat turned to me and said, "You're not going to believe this." And I said, "What?" "Well, Tommy and Doug and my brothers-in-law, and they all saying, you better marry this girl right away. You don't want to let her get away." And I started to shake. I said, "Oh my God," because marriage wasn't a good thing for me, you know. I said, "Oh no." And he said, "I know. Isn't that the weirdest thing?" So.
And that was the first time that word had ever come up between the two of you.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It was the first time that that idea even had come up. I just thought, well, we'll just go on like this, being really the best of friends and, you know, with some physical stuff. So I didn't realize that other people were seeing it very different.
Okay, so what was the next step?
She came to the hospital while I was working one day, and she was all dressed up in her business clothes, and she just looked beautiful to me. And I looked at her and I said, "How did I get so lucky? I really think I'm in love with her." And it kind of scared me because I thought, wow, you know, there's a lot at stake here, but I really think I love her. And it was just that one day I saw her, I said, you know, I'm going to have to do something here.
You know? Go on.
Well, the first thing I did is went to a counselor. I said, you know, I really, my life is so good. And I just saw him one time and I remember saying, look, you know, things are great. I don't know. Am I supposed to marry her? I'm afraid to move forward. And he just like, you know, I can't tell you what to do, but if it's everything you say it is, then go for it.
And so we got married December 18th.
How long ago now?
This will be 21 years this year.
Yep. And it's been an amazing journey.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. As Allison and Pat formalized their relationship, there was that question that families like theirs face. How do the two boys, Tyler and Clay, fit into all this?
You know, I think Pat fell in love with the boys long before he fell in love with me. I realized, wow, I've never seen a father interact with children this well, and here he wasn't even their father, you know, and he was the hired caretaker. I simply couldn't believe the magic that I was seeing day in and day out. One time I was coming back from a business trip, summertime, slogging through the airport with a heavy briefcase and my suitcase, and I was looking around for their car and I didn't see it, and all of a sudden I felt something on me, and they were hiding behind the car and squirting water at me through squirt guns. And the boys were giggling so much, and they were, you know, there's mommy, and squirting me. And Pat, of course, had the super soaker. He had the giant one. And I just remember thinking, I am so incredibly blessed. This is amazing.
I'm curious to know, when the boys started calling you Dad, Pat, who noticed that first? Allison, was it you?
It was on a Father's Day. Ty said, "Pat, what do you want me to give you for Father's Day?" And he said, I'd like you to start calling me Dad. And he said, "Huh, I think I can do that."
I was obviously pleased with it, and I felt like maybe, you know, I really am their father. And, you know, the biological part of it didn't matter anymore.
I think our older son had been much more hurt by his old dad, we called him his old dad. And so the word dad carried a lot of negative connotations. It was a sign of Tyler healing, I think.
We all realize today, and they're 26 and 24, how special it's been for all of us, for me to be able to parent them and adopt them, for Allison to see her happiness that she has had. It's been good.
I'm just thinking how lucky you guys are.
We're incredibly lucky. You know, I could have married a fellow that was a great dad, but that maybe he and I weren't that close. But, you know, I just feel like I've found truly one of the most magnificent people on the planet. I just can't believe it. There's still no one in the world I'd rather be with than Pat.
That's it's pretty amazing.
And a happy Father's Day to Pat and Allison Keenan and their three children. Pat and Allison also have a daughter together. And Pat and Allison join me from a studio in Milwaukee. So, question for you, Dick. Yes. Where do you find these people? I'm glad you asked. Pat and Allison wrote me to tell me their story, knowing that I'm such a sucker for a good love story. But if you have a story you'd like to talk with me about, a love affair, maybe someone that got away, maybe something completely different, you can find me at our website at thestory.org or call and leave me a message on our telephone line, 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. A little while ago, I talked with two women who had worked at a chicken processing plant. Rita Perry and Emma Pender weren't very complimentary about those jobs, even years after their time on the chicken line. They both say they continue to have trouble with their hands.
I can't stand for my hands to get cold anymore.
Even now?
Right now. And this, you see how my fingers are separating?
You're holding up your hands.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. Your little finger sticks out to one side, right?
It's like I'm deformed in that hand. And it hurts so bad that at nights if I'm laying in the bed and if it's cool in the room, I have to take my hands and put them underneath my pillow to get them warm because all the way up it starts aching.
And I got 15% carpal tunnel in both hands. That means I drop things easily.
Does that happen even now?
Mm-hmm. I just said I dropped a whole pitcher of iced tea on the floor this week.
When Rita and Emma were talking on the radio, Bob Hancock was listening and likely nodding his head. He's a chicken farmer who used to supply those processing plants, and he's gone through quite a transformation of his own from that job to independence. See, Bob was once a contract chicken grower, and he didn't much like that. He felt like a babysitter. And it all came down to an argument over the way that a chicken house is built.
They tell you how to raise their chickens, which they have the right to. It's their chickens.
But you don't have a whole lot of say in the matter, not a whole lot of independence.
No,
right?
And if you come up with a new idea, well, that's not the way we're doing this because we're following company standards here.
Is that what happened to you? You tried to innovate a little bit?
Or? Well, yes, to a certain extent. They wanted houses built to a certain specification, and the last four houses I built, I have eight now, but the last four I built, one of them built pretty close to the same as the first four. So if I had somebody come in to look after my houses, I could teach them on one house, and that's it. They would know how to run all eight.
So what's wrong with that?
Nothing. But it's not the way they wanted it. They want a house built to a certain specification, period. And that's it.
Bob Hancock was eventually dropped by the processing plant, and it was the beginning of a long, painful time for him.
When I was cut off from the poultry company, I was out for a whole year. I tried to go back to one of my first companies I'd raised for, and they wouldn't have nothing to do with me. And I called another. They wouldn't have nothing to do with me either. So I was what I think I was basically blacklisted. And I sat at my house looking out my window at the company bringing prospective buyers to my farm.
But you owned the farm, didn't you?
Yeah, but I might as well not have because without chickens, I got no income.
And you got a lot of debt, I suppose.
Got a huge. I had $500,000 in debt on four houses.
Wow, so you stopped producing chickens for these people and they still kind of had you by the throat.
Yeah,
right?
Well, no, they didn't. They just.
But they were bringing people around who might buy your
They basically
place, right?
Threw you to the side, though. You were no longer any use to them because you rocked a boat. And, they would bring people down, and, you know, I would stay away, you know, because that's fine. And then they wanted me to sell my house, too. And my house was not even attached to the farm. But my best well was at my house, and I have a line running between the properties, a water line.
And they need the water from that well.
They need the water, and they wanted me to sell my house because they thought I would cut the water off in anger to whoever might would buy the farm. And I'm not like that.
What was that year like for you?
Horrible. It's probably the lowest I've ever been in my life. The lowest. I can't think of anything lower than that.
How did you pass the time?
I had some real good friends. Have some real good friends. Two of my best friends, I ate lunch with them just about every day. And they would talk to me, and I did get a few jobs. I worked at CVS for 4 or 5 months. Cash register, whatever, which I hit it in stride. I mean, I'm a hard worker. Try to be. And I worked at a furniture company in Siler City. Really good man. I'll take my shirt off and whatever for him. And, you know, I'll dig a ditch for him if I have to because he's a real nice man. And, you know, worked there for a little while. But it was really just to live off of. Had nothing to do with the farm as far as making my payment every month for the $500,000 I owed. It was just to make living from myself and my wife and our daughter.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Bob Hancock eventually started raising chickens again. He worked with a neighbor, and it helped keep him on the farm. And that was when they caught wind of a different market for chickens.
New York City is the largest live market system in North America, if not the world, maybe, you know, because New York City.
And live market means you're taking live chickens to live a market and selling
is,
them when they're
yes,
still alive.
Live market is you're carrying chickens up to a distributor in New York or in maybe across the river in New Jersey is where they come in at, and then they go out from there into the markets in Brooklyn and Queens and stuff like that to the live markets. And we got kind of contact with a guy up there, and he sent his truck down. And we loaded it. It was a double-axle truck. We could put, I don't know, 2,000, 2,500, maybe 3,000 birds
not
on it.
Not one of these
one
great
time.
Big 18-wheelers.
No, not an 18-wheeler. No, it was just a regular double-axle truck. We would load that up once a week, basically, send it up there to him. It did pretty good for a while, but this guy's checks started bouncing all over the place. He still owes me $5,000, so I don't deal with him no more. But through him, I got up with a guy in Orlando, which at the time he owned a store in New York, a live market store. And he was selling that and moving to Orlando and building a store down there. And I got on with him, and, you know, one thing led to another. I would get another customer, I'd get another customer, I'd get another customer. And I worked real close with the state of Florida, with the Florida Department of Agriculture, worked real close with the North Carolina Department of Agriculture. And if there's an individual in Florida that wants to find a distributor for live chickens, they'll call the state of Florida, Department of Agriculture, and they give them my name and my number.
You have to help me with this. Mm-hmm. Who's buying live chickens now? I mean, it seems to me most people get that frozen chicken from the supermarket.
Yeah, they do. I don't really sell to individuals, so to speak.
But like, you need to know who's buying these,
I suspect. Oh, yeah, and I've learned a whole lot. This is a different side of the poultry industry that you wouldn't think about. The people that I sell to are the stores that they have every kind of bird. They do goat. They do sheep. Anything that a customer would want, they have at these places. Some of them are like wholesalers. They bring all this stuff in, and then somebody comes up from another town or another city down there, and they buy two or three guineas, two or three ducks, two or three goats or pigs or whatever, and then they carry them back to their hometown and sell them from there. So it kind of is a trickle-down effect for them. It's a good thing, and I've really got educated by it.
But I see, what I'm thinking is that the kind of live market you're describing, Bob, is a kind of live market that my grandparents would have been more familiar with.
They probably would have.
So who's buying it today? Is it mainly ethnic consumers who
yes.
have to have their animals
yes.
live?
It's all Central and South America people. It's Oriental people.
Caribbean people.
All the Caribbean, yeah. All the Caribbean. See, a lot of the owners of these stores are Guyanese from the Caribbean. Don't know why, but two of my customers are from Guyana. One's a woman, one's a man. They both come from New York. My main customer, this man that came from New York, I was his first customer. I opened his store up with chickens, which, you know, was almost 4 years ago now.
Tell me something. The poultry processing plants, the people you used to raise chickens for, they would have all these standards of, you know, it's got to be a certain weight, it's got to be this, it's got to be this. The people who want to buy the live birds, what are they asking for from you, Bob? What's a good bird in their estimation? Are they saying they want, you know, organic feed and cage-free and all that stuff? Or what kind of, what are the demands?
Each customer has different demands. One customer might want the largest bird you can raise, an 8-10 pound chicken.
That's a big bird.
Big chicken. In Orlando, they want the white Cornish cross, the commercial style white chickens.
That's the standard picture of a chicken that chickens. I would
have. Yeah, now your daddy and my daddy, a standard chicken would be a Dominecker.
Which
a Bard Rock, a gray speckled chicken.
Yeah.
That would be the dominant chicken back in the 60s and 50s. The further south you go in Florida, it changes. They don't want the whites. They want a red chicken. They want the Dominecker, the grays. They want anything with color. They want something familiar. They want a red chicken, a gray chicken, and we basically go by the colors. You know,
and
red
you're
chicken,
happy to oblige.
I'm happy to oblige, yes, sir.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Bob Hancock found that he was having fun. He was raising poussin, Cornish hens, pheasants, partridge, turkeys. And these days, just about every week, Bob's driving his truck to and from Florida. It takes about 10 to 12 hours, and most of that driving is done at night.
Sunlight and heat kills chicken real quick. That's why I try to leave early afternoon. Last week, it was so hot. I left last Friday when it was like 95, 98 degrees. I left at 7 o'clock that evening, drove all night, got there. I had to get there at least by 6 o'clock in the morning to start unloading. So by the time I got down below Tampa, it was maybe 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm pushing the whole way. You know, as soon as I get my first customer, y'all hurry up, let's go, let's get the chickens off. Need to get on the next place, and so on, so on, so on. And the only time I stop to either get anything to eat or drink might be when I'm getting a tank of gas. And I carry 3 or 4 gas cans in the back of the truck because gas in South Carolina is cheaper state tax, so I'll fill them up. So 9 times out of 10, I'm not stopping for gas because I got it. And I won't tank up again until I'm at the last place and I'm done. And if I get anything to eat, it might be a soft drink or a pack of Nabs. Usually I don't eat any kind of big meal until I'm done. You know,
every chicken is off that truck?
Every chicken's off that truck.
Huh.
It's tough.
I kind of want to know what the change has been like for you from working for someone, babysitting someone else's chickens, as you say, to being as independent as you are now. Do you like this?
Yes. I mean, I love chickens anyway. I love raising chickens. It is stressful. I have to buy the feed. I have to buy the chicks. I look for customers. I've got all I need right now, but, I mean, you always lose a customer and you take on another, whatever. It is stressful.
So where's the satisfaction in it? What's a moment that you fix on when you think to yourself, this is exactly what I want to be doing?
When my farm's paid off.
And are you paying that debt down?
Oh, yes, I am. I'm down. I was 500. Now I'm around 300.
Congratulations.
This is since 2002. So it's every week is a challenge, though. I have to balance between my home bills, farm bills, and whatever in between.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more, though, Bob, about that sense of satisfaction that you get from doing it on your own. I mean, do you feel that sense of satisfaction when you're behind the wheel of the truck on your way down to Florida? Is it making the delivery? What are those moments that where you think that life is better today than it was when you were just raising someone else's chickens?
Well, I know there's nobody over my shoulder saying, you need to do this, you need to do that. other than my wife maybe, but you know, she's good about that. But it's just being your own boss. Even though when I was a contract grower, you know, I was my own boss of my houses, so to speak, but to a certain extent, had its limitations. Where now, I control every aspect of whether I lose money or make money.
Your success is your success, and your failure is your failure.
It right? is. I can't blame anybody else but me, and that's it.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. And you can't tell a business story these days without talking about the rising cost of doing business. For example, the cost of chicken feed, because it's mainly corn, the cost of gas, they've both doubled.
I've got to charge more, and I've raised my prices for my chicken, well, three or four times, and they buck you too.
Have you lost customers for having done that?
Temporarily. But then they would come back. Then they would come back because they couldn't find any anywhere else. Pat me on the back for sure. They would come back. I raised the prices on my first customer, the guy in Orlando. Raised prices on him right after Katrina went through New Orleans. And gas prices jumped up. I said, I've got to add a fuel surcharge. I don't know how long it'll be, but I've got to add $20 or $40 a customer fuel surcharge. And when the prices dropped back down, that went away too. But now that prices have gone back up, I've just added to the chicken. I said, well, you know, chicken's X amount a pound right now. And, you know, I lost one customer for a while. He found somebody to raise some chickens for him about 3 hours away from where his store was. He got them for a while. But he had to go pick them up. Well, there's a 6-hour round trip for him, and he wanted to be in the store.
And you were willing to deliver.
And I deliver. And he has come back to me. We're good friends to a business sense, and I work pretty close with him. And I work real close with all of them. And I try to be honest with them. I mean, you can't be anything else but honest. And somebody will say, why have you gone up on your prices? What planet are you from? You evidently haven't been on this planet long to see what's been happening. And, you know, they're going to complain anyway, and you just got to go with the flow.
If one of these big poultry plants came back to you and said, okay, we'll take your chickens. We'd like you to be our babysitter again. You're shaking your head.
No, never.
Why?
It was such a sad time and traumatic time in my life. I don't want to relive that again. Because if I did go back, I think I would be under the gun the whole time. And too much worry, too much stress. I don't want that. I don't need that. I've been through it already.
Do you eat a lot of chicken yourself?
Yes, sir, I sure do.
And can you tell the difference between that piece of frozen bird that comes from the supermarket and that one that had its neck wrung in the backyard?
With a chopping block. Yeah, most definitely I can tell.
You ever troubled by the smell of raising chickens?
Mm-mm. It don't bother me. I had some motorcyclists got in behind me one day going down, and I seen one guy wave his hand in front of his face, you know, knew the smell. And I just stuck my hand out the window, or stuck my arm out the window, and rubbed my fingers together. It smells like money to me.
Bob Hancock joined me here in the Story Studio in Chapel Hill. I'm always on the lookout for this kind of business story, any kind of business story that helps us understand this world, your world, how it works. If you have a suggestion, you can get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org or call me, 1-888-966-9862. The Story is produced by Corey Princell, Denise Schreiner, and Anita Woodley, helping out this week Tim Anderson and Nick Vidinsky. Our researcher is Jeanette Arrowood. Rachel McCarthy and Jen Nathan work as our audio editors. Al Wadarski and Peter Bombar are our engineers. The Story's managing editor and director is Carol Jackson. The senior producer of The Story is Greg Kelly. And working with us as our summer intern team, Andrew Ives, Sheila Reed, Elizabeth Templin, Andrew Hibbard, and Eleanor Workman. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.